Welcome to Sex Psychic Psychedelics. I'm Jane Garnett, a licensed psychotherapist, and I'm here to accelerate your personal growth. Because life is too short to not get turned on. Yes. Okay, so my guest today is Dr. Kat Meyer, who is a yoga teacher of 16 years, as well as a psychotherapist specializing in sexual trauma and psychedelics. Her podcast is called Sex, Love, and Psychedelics. My podcast is called Sex, Psychics, and Psychedelics. I have found a member of my tribe. I'm super excited. Thank you
so much. Woo! Yes, yeah. Let's bring it.
It's kind of nuts, isn't it? I just feel like, what kind of a sandbox am I playing in that I get to do this with you?
A sandbox full of sparkliness and glitter and unicorns to play around. Look at your shoes. Look at these shoes. Yes.
Thank you for mentioning my shoes, Kat.
We are in the same sandbox of glitter. Yes. Let's go.
Life glitter, right? Let's keep it sparkly. Okay. So let's start out with the game. What do sex and psychedelics have in common? I'll kick it off if you want. Okay. I'm going to think of three things. Sex and psychedelics are... Hopefully fun. Hopefully enjoyable. Mostly unpredictable. And often enlightening.
Ooh, okay. Okay.
Over to you.
Yeah. Sex and psychedelics for me, sometimes they... You're sitting there and you have no idea why you're here. Sometimes they can rock you with the fullest energy and just being fucked open by God. There we go. And then another one, they, running off of what you said earlier, they can be expansive and they can be expensive.
Oh, they can be expensive. Watch out for your wallet. When people say they will cure you in the course of a weekend, usually okay. Takes a little longer.
Yeah, watch out for your wallet. But I was also going to say, watch out for what you have to pay in the experience, right? You have to give up so much. And sometimes we're like, well, fuck, I don't want to give up this, you know, in order to grow. And so there's a lot of expensiveness there where we're like, in the throes of it, we're like, I don't want to let this go, you know?
Absolutely. The cost of letting go. And what you're saying makes me think about as well, like, for me as a seeker, I wonder if you identify, I've always been pushing for the bigger expanse. Now, to find the bigger expanse has meant letting go of whatever the current box is, the box du jour, right? So that's all fun and games and well and good until suddenly you're like, oh fuck, where are the boxes, where are the houses, where's the certainty, where's that thing I thought I knew? And there's just less and less and less of it, and there's more and more and more just openness and spinning, and mm-hmm. at best that's fun and games, and at worst, or at least at most challenging, that is quite scary. It's a bigger and bigger and bigger world. It's a bigger and bigger and bigger landscape. And it's my path, but sometimes I'm like, oh shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, I think psychedelics remind us of the ever-present mystery of life. And we go into it thinking that we might know, or we're looking for certainty, we're looking for the answer. But it brings us to that relationship with the mystery. Mm. And it humbles us, and it breaks through these thoughts that we might have had about how something was, or even our own identity, and puts us face to face with the reality of the mystery of life. As much as we want to create structure, and structure can be a helpful resource to create organization so we're not in chaos. However, at the end of the day, we still have the mystery of life. So do we want to grip on to something that we think that we know, or do we want to relax into, I don't fucking know? Mm. And it can be painful to grip and hold on in a ceremony. You know, if you don't let go to it, and you never realize that it can softly pick you up and take you on a pleasant, pleasurable journey of ecstasy, but you cannot even approach that if you are tensing everything to hold on and not let go.
I mean, I think most of my journeys have been that holding on and, and not letting go. And certainly my, I would say like the definitely the first 7 years of doing psychedelics for me, meaning the plant medicines, not the kind of party time MDMA or whatever.
Well, MDMA, I will interject though, MDMA is powerful in the therapeutic
setting. I totally agree within the, the therapeutic. I've had a long journey and I want to talk about that with MDMA, but just, you know, at least at the beginning of my plant medicine journey, I don't know, maybe that's like 16 years ago or something like that. The first 7 years were shadow, just me and my shadow. And I still have shadow coming up. We always have shadow, but it was all of this like dark, gnarly, dark night of the soul material. And I mean, that was partly because that was where I was at. But I think it was also that I didn't actually think there was another option. I thought personal growth was only about shadow. And I think we're also trained in that as therapists. We're looking at the past. We're looking at what went wrong. We're looking at our blocks. And partly I've lightened up along the way through metabolizing some of those shadows. But partly I've also learned like, oh, we can also journey into the light that has its own challenges. Because things can get pretty bright in the light as well. There's a lot to take in out there. So what do you think about this? Do you work with these concepts of shadow and light in your own practice?
Yeah, you know, as you were talking, you're right. There seems to be a fascination, and especially recently, for this shadow work where people are like, I'm doing shadow work now. And they're like, well, I got to go down into the depths of the dark and the trash and like, you know, excavate what's there, you know, what's being hidden from my subconscious. And we also forget that there's also the golden shadow that Carl Jung labeled as these parts of ourselves, these light attributes of ourselves that have been suppressed, turned off, hidden, put into our subconscious for our preservation. So for some of this, those were the times when we were little and we were exuberant and vibrant, and this triggered our mom thinking that our life force energy, our vibrancy was sexual energy, which is dangerous and you can't be that. And you have to turn that off. Or those times where we were loud and we were like, mama, 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 when we were little and we were told to shut up or be quiet or don't do that. And yet, you know, all of these beautiful light attributes that were deemed unsafe to be, to express, including our sexuality, you know, touching our body, enjoying our body. As a child, rubbing ourselves up against a flagpole, you know, like.
Who doesn't love to rub themselves up against a flagpole, a tree,
a chair, like, come on, a teddy bear, I don't know. Yeah, it feels good.
Yeah.
But because pleasure was something that was dangerous, you know, especially for the generation before us, and still even now, there's the imprint of it. We were taught to not. And so it becomes the golden shadow that we can do the work to remember, to touch on, to give ourselves permission, and to train ourselves, retrain ourselves that it is safe to be ourselves. It is safe to be authentic and to be fully expressed. And so I think if we shift, if we recognize we can shift the perspective, the lens to look for that rather than to dig in the, you know, the trash can, these other words, like how that might shift our way of being able to transmute pain into pleasure and, access our whole selves. Like I think of the concept of Eros, and the concept of Eros is wholeness. And so it's wholeness and it's aliveness. And so if we go into this work seeking for what's alive in ourselves, and where even where we deaden or where we're not alive, that's just as important. And so we go into these psychedelic experiences, even sexual experiences, and there's information not just in the ecstasy, but places where we are bored, places where we feel pain or dissociate or deaden, you know, in ourselves. And so how can we look for the golden shadows in these places, all in the wholeness of these places, to find healing?
I love that. I love looking for for the golden shadows. And as you were talking, I was thinking about, you were talking about it as the past, you know, like, oh, there were these places where maybe, you know, mom or somebody, maybe one of your classmates found you to be too much, you know. I mean, I have so many stories of this. But it's a theme that continues, I feel like, less in the culture that we're in. Like, I came to see you today thinking, like, yay, you know, this woman who's thriving and she's got a podcast similar to mine and I'm genuinely excited to meet her. The culture that I came from, I feel like it would be framed a little bit more as competition, you know, it'd be a bit like, you know, and maybe both of us as well would be seen to be like, who does she think she is? Kind of like living the life of her dreams and, you know, all this kind of thing. And there are times when I still have that, like, I mean, I feel like I've even been explicitly asked by people to kind of tone it down and to shine less. And even now, and I'm like, is that a facet of my own unconscious that's getting projected? Am I still seeking that out in some kind of way? Or is that just the world that we live in where people still can't get their fucking heads around the fact that there's plenty of room at the top? Like, there's plenty of room at the top. And P.S., we're not that important. Like, both of those things are the case. You know what I mean? However brightly I shine in this lifetime, I mean, it'll be great for me and hopefully the people around me, but it still doesn't matter that much, bigger scheme of things. Mm-hmm. But the egoic way that things are structured, I think there's still a sense of like, you know, don't shine all the way bright because we still have to make space for each other.
Sure. And I had that in my life too, you know, and there was this internal core belief that, if I stepped into my power and I was loud, it would hurt people. It would threaten people. People would not feel safe around me.
How did that manifest? Like, was that parents or school or what?
Yeah. I think a little bit of family of origin. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of competition in my lineage. And then, of course, you know, in school too. And that's something that we have to remember. You know, these are shadows that can exist on the personal level, but then on the macro collective level. Mm. And so what we're digesting may not be ours. What we're experiencing and being met with, it may not be ours, but it still lives in us. You know, we still have access to these different archetypes that exist all throughout the world. And when I say archetypes, it's these common themes that show up across cultures, across countries and races and ages. And so it's any of us can have these experiences. Any of us can give these experiences. And I think that can bring us back into the compassion of these shared experiences that we have all had or have the possibility of tapping into, if the conditions are correct, right? And so somebody who is activated by the fear of you being too loud is there at the core of it. It's a part inside of them that feels vulnerable to getting lost or not being able to survive or not being able to belong to a group anymore. You know, there's something, and these are just some of the voices.
I think what you said about, I think maybe you even said survive, but it made me think about scarcity. And I know that I've had that in the past, that sometimes someone else's expression will read as your own scarcity. And I think that's quite interesting. And maybe it's jealousy, maybe it's not, but I really like looking at jealousy as like the undeveloped part of yourself. Like, if something makes you jealous, it's such a good opportunity to look at the part of yourself that still wants something. What is that? You know, what is it that you still want? Want being, you know, lack. There's some feeling of like, I lack this. I need this thing to survive and I don't have it. And I think if we look at that with compassion, it's like, oh, okay, there's something to cultivate here. It's just like something that wants to grow.
Yeah, and something that wants our attention and wants us to understand that their feelings are valid given what they've experienced in their lives. I had that experience 2 weeks ago where I told a girlfriend, there was a situation I was in, and I was like, I'm feeling jealous right now. I'm feeling this, I'm feeling rage, and I'm also feeling jealous, and I'm noticing. And so just, giving that part my attention, like a secure parent would their child, not trying to exile the child, not trying to minimize it, not trying to ignore it, but just be like, yeah, you have feelings. And I'm doing that inside of myself.
Yeah. I mean, it's rough though, isn't it? Because I mean, jealousy, and I love talking about jealousy because it's such a rough feeling. I know for me, it's one of the hardest. My ego doesn't want to accept that I'm feeling jealous. I mean, come on, you're beyond that now. Come on, you've done enough sex psychics and psychedelics to get beyond it. It's like, no, you're a human, so sorry, you are going to have jealousy. But yeah, I mean, how you actually do that, I think, is a good question. I mean, you and I have been sort of questing for years on this, right? We've been thinking about this a lot in our work with ourselves and our work with other people, but like, fast track, how do we look at these parts of ourselves and actually practice love? Do you have any kind of practical tips on this?
I do. Yeah. So the work that I do in my office is internal family systems. And so it's a lot of like, I got to pause and unblend, meaning take a pause, self-regulate, which many people don't have that skill to self-regulate. Mm. And so they're just running in a dysregulated state and they can't get out of this loop. You know, pause, sit, breathe, calm, then turn towards the feelings, the sensations, the thoughts, the images.
The unpleasant thoughts.
The unpleasant pieces, yeah. But even unpleasant is still a part of us that's judging something rather than just being with the experience as it is. And so it's recognizing that, you know, can I approach these parts with curiosity, presence, patience? Sometimes those can come quicker than compassion. You know, sometimes with curiosity, then we can access compassion because we're getting the answers and we're seeing memories of where this came from, or we're seeing a very scared part of ourselves and or a part that's been exhausted because it's working really, really hard to protect us. And I think from there, it's like, you know, seeing the adorableness of these little parts inside of ourselves with the little fire hose, just like putting out the fire, you know, wanting to make sure that we're okay. So things like that, you know, pausing, taking the time with ourselves, being present with ourselves. If we're asking other people to pay attention to us, if we're asking for other people to show up for us and to be accommodating for us, how are we doing that for ourselves? Except we're just rushing through our day. So journaling, breathing, self-regulating, you know, making your body right, accepting that your body has needs and giving it to them rather than overriding your body in whatever state it's in because it's been trying to get our attention for a really long time. And every fluctuation of it, letting that just be okay. And also giving our bodies this sense of affection, you know, kindness towards the body and touch, kind touch and caress.
Sort of self-touch we're talking about.
Yeah.
I like that. I mean, I often think that there's a lot of talk about masturbation and sort of the sexual side of self-touch. And I know for me, the kind of more like the nurturing side of self-touch has actually been more of a more nourishing journey. Like for me to find sexual pleasure has never been a problem. It's just been like a straight shoot kind of situation.
Beautiful. I'm happy for you.
Thank you. I'm happy for me too. And I want to hear about your journey. So sex for me has been easier than the sort of sexual pleasure journey has always been felt like very much like a natural way for me. But the emotional journey has been harder. So for me, often the exchange sort of in a sexual situation is I'm giving my sexual freedom and what I'm receiving or wanting is more like comfort. More the kind of emotional soothing. So emotional soothing has felt harder for me to access. And then that's also sort of played itself out in my relationship with my own body. And it's still a journey, but to remember like I can actually like touch my own head or like, you know, squeeze myself or like, you know, just to make contact in a kind way with your own body. For me, that's kind of a revelation and something I want to keep remembering to do, you know.
That's so beautiful. And you make a really good point. How many of us have conditioned ourselves that if we're touching our body, it has to be sexual?
Right. Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. We're going into a masturbation session. Yeah.
Sexual, or I'm cleaning my body in the shower.
Yeah. We forget that there's so many other ways we can touch our body.
That's right. That's
yeah. And it also doesn't have to be another person's hands. Yeah.
I mean, even down to like the way that we put, I mean, as you know, there's so much focus around beauty, right? Beauty products and, you know, what this product is doing for your skin. But like, what about the way that you put the product into your skin? Mm-hmm. Like, is that touch? And I often forget because I'm cramming the fucking whatever the miracle product is. It's going to make me younger and more beautiful. So I'm just cramming it into my skin. But like, what about that sort of, what about the conscious touch?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we don't really know. We know that it's healing. We know that it's soothing. We don't really know. But sometimes I even like imagine like something like being transmitted through the fingertips into the skin. You know, and it can be love if you put your mind there.
Yeah. And there's a different energetic in that experience too. Mm. I remember years ago I did in my early days of Tantra study back in my 20s. There was one immersion that I did in Thailand where we did the practice of sitting in front of a mirror with makeup and adornments and jewels. And it was a meditation experience of worshiping ourselves and adorning ourselves with this makeup. So it transformed the way that I understood makeup because we're conditioned. Yeah, there's so many messages in society that puts naturalism as this hierarchy, you know, of like, oh, if you're natural, that's better. Like, don't put makeup on or don't get something.
Or put makeup on so that you look natural.
Yeah, I know. That's a whole other thing. Yeah. Or, you know, don't do this to your body or don't do that. And it's also like, well, we can transform something into a ritual. We can bring presence and love and care into any of these things. And it creates even more shame around people who want to make a decision for themselves for whatever reason that they want to. And I think that takes the power away from women's agency for their own bodies. And we've had enough of that
when
in society.
I agree about what you're saying, but when you're talking about shame, what were you referring to specifically?
The shame of
where do you want to start?
I know. So
which shame should we talk about now?
Yeah. Every human in the world has been present to the collective shadow and the shame on this is how you're supposed to be, this is how you're supposed to act, this is how you're supposed to look, this is, you know, in order to be worthy of love. And for women, and this was so beautifully put with Barbie, you know, there was this dialogue with America Ferrera where she was saying, you know, don't be too slutty, but be sexual. Don't be this. And so there's this like pressure to be natural. And we see this a lot, especially in the quote unquote conscious communities and especially in, you know,
the enlightened plastic surgeon's office.
Enlightened. Actually, I want to change that.
Yeah.
Because it is okay. Because even that statement is saying that what you're choosing is not okay.
Yeah.
It's not enlightened. I don't even believe in the word enlightened because it puts such a pressure on us when really being human is divine.
Yes. Thank you. Being human is divine. I agree. I think enlightened is a dicey word.
I've worked with women
who
wanted to have plastic surgery. I've worked with many women who had breast reduction, breast enhancement, you know, for whatever reason, or wanted to put something in their lips or wanted to, and doing ketamine sessions with them or doing regular therapy sessions with them, but especially the ketamine sessions and them touching on, oh, I can love myself anyway. Like if I want to make this decision, I can still love myself. I can still, you know, and it just is beautiful to give anybody back their agency to do what they want. in this world, rather than us shame them for doing something and thinking like, oh, well, you're insecure for wanting to do that, or why would we?
Or yeah, and the idea that you're separating from yourself,
right?
Yeah. Which I think is the common judgment around it, which is you're leaving yourself behind. But what is that? What is yourself? What are the limits of the self? You know, are we allowed to manipulate our bodies? Are we allowed to change our bodies? Are we allowed to change our minds? Are we allowed to change our faces? Are we allowed to change our jobs?
We can do whatever the fuck we want.
This is true. And actually, I had a fight with my daughter the other day, 17-year-old, who is very good at throwing up difficult mirrors mm-hmm. that I have the pleasure of being able to process mm-hmm. with myself and with her. We have a really extraordinary kind of learning relationship. But she said to me, "Mom, you're never satisfied. You're always doing this and you're mm-hmm. always doing that. And then you're mm-hmm. trying this and then, you know." Blah, blah. And at first I had a, you know, shame response. I was like, oh gosh, is this what I'm modeling for my child? And then I kind of moved beyond it and I was like, it's true. I'm never satisfied. You know, I was just like, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm never satisfied. Mm-hmm. It's true. I'm not satisfied. Mm-hmm. I'm alive. You know, I'm moving. I'm questing. I'm yearning. I'm growing. I'm not satisfied. And I'm not going to be satisfied. Mm-hmm. That's not, I'm not looking to stop.
Mm-hmm. So with that, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. That's,
I mean, you could say
so
be satisfied
beautiful.
With not being satisfied, but yeah, then
but
we're just playing.
No,
you know?
I love the energy yeah. that you put behind that, because that's also, you know, I do believe that there is also the importance of integrating anything that we do. So if we're going to have a surgery, are mm. we integrating what we've done?
Mm-hmm.
Are we taking the time to bring mindfulness and conscious awareness and then celebrate and be with our body afterward to reduce this never-ending cycle of body dysmorphia, which cannot be fixed by changing ourselves, changing mm-hmm. our body. We will be in this endless cycle. So with anything that we do, are we doing an integration process? So allowing ourselves, but still bringing the conscious awareness and doing the process that we need to. And I think that, and as well as bringing the conscious awareness to the impact of social media and the impact of filters and the impact of all of that. So that we're coming to any of these decisions with agency, but also with a lot of conscious awareness.
Agreed. And I think for me, a nice perspective on these kinds of things, like surgery or changing yourself in different ways is not to pin too much hope on the outcome of the action, that the action is the expression.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But before that action that I take to enhance myself in whatever way that I feel hopeful about, and that's great, but I don't think I'm going to find myself through it. I don't think I'm going to find myself through the relationship, through the surgery, through the job change, through explaining to my daughter that I'm this, not that, whatever it is, right? That I'm myself before I do any of these things.
Yeah.
And then results may vary after that, right?
Isn't that the same with psychedelics too? Psychedelics are not the answer.
Oh, no.
We still have to do the work. We still have to do the work.
So annoying.
That's the thing.
So true.
How are we creating these savior relationships with all these things, expecting that to save us from our situation, our pain, our, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not going to. And we're disappointed at the end because it didn't do it.
Yeah.
We still got to do the work.
I mean, I think that's the setup of psychedelics, right? Mm-hmm. Is that particularly for the dreamers, people like me, as you see these beautiful images of how it can be, how you can be, and you know, and then you go back into the mess. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's, I mean, I've had so many bumpy integrations and they can still continue, but I feel like I've gotten a bit better over time at kind of sorting out what is important. And if I see... if I see something that can really help one of my relationships, you know, an apology, a positive mirror that I can hold up to someone, you know, a conversation, usually it's some kind of slowing down and relating. I'll put that straight into action. If it's something that's more kind of like, I think of as a bit more cracked out, like I, you know, see myself on top of the mountain in a cape or something, you know. I mean, I might do it, but you know,
probably sounds great. Let's go, Jane.
Let's go. Yeah, it's just like, you know, there are different levels of these things. You start to tune in, you know, is this thing that I'm seeing on psychedelics when I take it back home with me afterwards, does this feel wholesome? Does it feel connected?
Mm.
Is it likely to help someone else, you know? Or is it
like
something
service?
Does it feel like service? Does it have that human quality to it? In which case I'm like, fuck yeah. And I've had so many experiences, honestly, that I found helpful. But also I've done so much therapy and so many other things. And so that scares me, right? Because I think how difficult it is for me to integrate sometimes. Yeah. And then what about someone who hasn't actually even done like a bunch of therapy or work on themselves or yoga or anything, and then suddenly taking psychedelics? It's quite hard to sort through those levels. They're quite different, aren't they?
Oh my God, girlfriend, you just nailed it on the head. It's like that comment that people say without thinking about it, that psychedelics are like taking 10 years of therapy. And I'm like, no, that would be some shitty therapy.
Yeah, exactly. You gotta get
a different therapist.
Yeah.
Or also, yeah, it can be for those who've done therapy for 10 years, you know, to prep you, to prime you for that experience. And I was going to say something there about that. It's gone.
Do you want to hold it? And I mean, it'll come back to you, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But I was just thinking, as you were talking of a horizontal axis and a vertical axis, right? Mm-hmm. So see if I can do it with my hands. So psychedelics being a bit more the kind of the vertical axis, the ideational realm, being able to meet up with, you know, ancestors, pure ideas, celestial realms, the sky, the earth, traveling down, traveling up. And then we've got the horizontal axis, which is the, you know, the plodding human 1 hour after another hour kind of axis that we structure our weeks around. And I don't think one is more real than the other, but the ideal is where they intersect. In fact, the only place we can do anything is where they intersect. There is no doing anything anywhere else. The only thing we can do, right, the only good that comes is when the vertical axis meets the horizontal axis anyway. Mm-hmm. That's where the action is. The rest is hot air. So I think, yeah, I think both are really valuable, but trying to have one without the other is really a lost cause.
Yeah, yeah. I remember what I was going to say, and it was because it sounds like you have cultivated such a beautiful level and relationship with discernment. And for me, that took a really long time. I had experiences of sexual trauma when I was younger and emotional neglect that made it, and still today I can catch it, of having a difficult time with confusion of, is my experience right or is it wrong? And
give me an example of that.
My experience
on psychedelics?
No. But yes, you said discernment. You were able to see whether, okay, this is wholesome, this is a good decision, this is right. And so for me, it took a long time to understand that, because even in psychedelics, you know, you have that time after the psychedelic where you're in this glittery light, like I feel strong, I feel courageous, and it's like, yeah, I can do this thing and do this thing and do this thing, but that's not the discernment that, like, I need to sit, let the energy settle, and then make those decisions, right? And then even then, it's, can I allow myself to make that decision or be right in that decision, rather than go back into the confusion of this thing that I need to do? I'm, you know, like whether it's break up with a person or you know, change careers or whatever. I can't do that anymore, you know, because that wouldn't be wholesome or that wouldn't be kind or that wouldn't be. And yet it very well could have been. It could be. And so it's just, it's the process after the psychedelic, and I guess really forever and ever and ever, is this process of discerning what is wholesome for me, what is right for me, what is okay, what is, you know,
Yeah, I mean, I think discernment is such a big deal in general as a human, right? There are so many ways we can go with so many things, especially when we start realizing the level of choice we potentially have, you know, in terms of our thoughts and our words and our actions. So, yeah, I think, firstly, we're never going to know what is existentially right. You know, I think we have to cut ourselves some slack in the sense that, look, we're going to make mistakes all over the place, and hopefully we can just learn from everything and have a sense of humor about it and some compassion and keep going. But yeah, to me, the metric is connection. It's really the only thing that makes sense to me in a continuous way.
But how are you defining what is connection, what isn't? And I'm thinking of this because as therapists, you know, we hold space for clients who are in the process of deciding whether they need to end a relationship or go on. And even if a relationship is loving, it's not meeting where they need to. And so them leaving is the kindest thing for them and for the relationship. And so it's like, how are we defining connection in that sense?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, I think for me, there's two connections. One is sort of the anticipated connection of how will this affect the other person in my life? And if that feels like it's going to affect them in a juicy, positive way, that's a positive indicator. The other is the connection to my own gut. Or, I don't even know if it's gut, but I remember I used to get so mad at my mom and frustrated because I always had a hard time making decisions. You know, I whip my mind this way and then that way and but on this hand and then the other, you know, real like fucking head case. And so I used to torture her with that. And she used to always say, you know, somewhere in you, there's a deepest truth. And I was like, I can't find my deepest truth.
Yeah.
And I think there is a deepest truth. I think it can take a while to get there. If you keep coming, if you keep coming up against it, it's like there's this, you know, there's a boulder in your landscape that needs to be dealt with. If it's just a one-off, like, oh, wow, that's an inspiring thought. Well, that's an inspiring thought. We don't know yet if that's your deepest truth. If you keep coming back and back to this inspiring thought that is about the liberation you're going to experience when you're going to split up with that person, I mean, you might be getting some information, right? So, yeah, I think there are these different, it's kind of a, well, it's a mystery and it's a maze, isn't it? The inner world.
It brings us back to the relationship of the mystery of life every time.
I know, I know. And I think for me that has been, I've just been so frustrated about it. And it's only been, and I still am, I still want to know, but it's doing a podcast with all these people who I think know stuff. But yeah, it's actually only been in my recent journeys. In fact, one of my biggest journeys recently, I just kept getting this message, you have to make space for the ineffable. And it was really good because the word ineffable made it sexy to me, because like the other words were just, you know, playing more into my frustration, but but ineffable had jazz hands for me. It was like, you're never gonna know, you're never gonna know, you know. And for me, I can go with that. Like if it's a little sexy, I can go with it.
Yes. And we got to be with the unsexy too.
Oh,
that's the wholeness, you know.
Yeah. Well, we got to make the unsexy sexy somehow.
All right, we'll put some sparkle shoes on it and let's go. Let's climb that mountain with a cape and these sparkle shoes.
You know, you understand who I am now at this point. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, for me, I don't know about you, but I'm a fantasist. You know, that's one of my shadows that I've started to, you know, love, actually, you know. You have to, gotta love it. You are too?
Yeah. Well, there is a part of me that uses fantasy to deal with hard things,
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an amazing resource. And I'd love to talk with you about this, because I think, for me, my relationship with fantasy, I didn't realize how strong it was, actually, until I basically got a lecture from a kind of shaman mystic about it. I got busted in a boga ceremony a while ago, and this dude who was very insightful said to me, like, you know, basically, like, look at your level of fantasy. It's pretty intense. And and so that started to open up for me. And at first there was so much shame around it, because it's somewhere where I've spent a lot of time. In a lot of, like, unrealistic places. So scary to look at. And then kind of, and I would say in an ongoing way, increasingly exciting to look at, because mm-hmm. what I'm discovering for myself, and I think also for some other people too, is that fantasy is this repository of fierce mm-hmm. energy mm-hmm. that is ours, that is mine, that is yours. The shame keeps us disconnected from it. Mm-hmm. Once we get into a more conscious connection to it, it's like, oh, that image of me in the cape flying around eating marshmallows, you know, is mine.
Yeah.
It comes from the child. It comes from the fucking imagination, which is one of the most blessed gifts, really. Okay. So then what you start to get in touch with is not like, oh, do I really want to put on a cape and fly around eating marshmallows? Now that sounds really great, but more like, wow, look how powerful my imagination is. Mm-hmm. Look how much energy is there in that mm-hmm. image. What is that image? Oh, it's an image of joy and freedom and playfulness and being a kid. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's me. And then you kind of can feed it back to yourself. Mm. It's your own nourishment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. And similar to like the concept of shadow, it's not to get that we to not go in with the agenda of trying to get rid of any of our parts and any of these things. It's developing a conscious relationship with them. What is it serving? What is its positive outcome? How is it protecting me? What is it doing here? What does it think or perceive in order to take care of me? And so fantasy can, you know, have collateral. You know, we can have to pay a lot in order to keep doing in that way. So for me, sometimes fantasy would show up as in relationships. I would fantasize about the relationship being really good. Mm-hmm. But the reality was I was getting breadcrumbs of attention, mm-hmm. you know, and working really, really hard. But I was in this fantasy of, oh my God, this is my dream relationship. It's getting everything. So it was protecting me from the pain of the reality of what was actually happening. And
right. Or what it could be like if you just fixed X,
right,
Y, and Z.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And then even then, sometimes in early in my career, I would spend a lot of time fantasizing and planning about what my career was going to mm-hmm. look like. Mm-hmm. And when it came to the action, I had a really hard time doing the action for it. And it made me exhausted. And then I realized there was a part running in the background of my mind of fear of failure. And so mm-hmm. fantasy protected me. Mm-hmm. As long as I stayed there, I was good and happy and great. But the action brought up the very deep vulnerability of mm-hmm. failure. So it's, yeah, we just get to create a relationship with it. I don't want to get rid of fantasy. I have
a
great time, a great storyteller because of it. And you are too.
Yeah.
And I get to look at, where is it?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the safety aspect of it. And I think that's the bitch, right?
Just got to call it as it is, yeah.
It's like, I have this perfect world, but to share it with anybody, I'm going to have to, face rejection, failure, disappointment, mm-hmm. disconnection. What if I share my fantasy with someone and they go like, what the fuck? You want to eat marshmallows flying around in a cape?
Yes,
that's
I do.
Stupid. Yeah. But she understands me. She gets me. She knows. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So
I think it's the safety of fantasy. It's a beautiful cocoon you can wrap yourself up in. But then, of course, the price.
Yeah.
Is you stay out of the game. Right?
Yeah. And it also just does make it more beautiful. Like, you know, not to discredit that part too. You know, there is a movie with Johnny Depp. And the whole movie is called Don Juan. Mm-hmm. And he transfigures this whole experience of being in a psych ward with this image and fantasy of being in a castle. And everybody who's in there are, you know, part of his castle, you know, and there's this woman that he's waiting for. He's not mentally unstable. He's just learned the power of transfiguration, transforming reality into divinity. And so I think, like, you know, how can we, again, find this relationship between when does my fantasy become, you know, when is it help, you know, making me things beautiful and helping me, and when does it, when does it become this
avoidance?
Yeah, avoidance. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. And let's try and get a bit more granular on that, because I think that's really the bee's knees, is bringing divinity into, I don't know what you said, the everyday or the every minute.
Yeah.
Give me an example of how you do that in the daily, in the kitchen, wherever it is. Yeah.
Let's see. I mean, I love creating spaces. This is physical. Let's see. Physically, I love creating beautiful spaces like you did. You brought these beautiful flowers in. You got your very phallic banana here.
I didn't put it up right like that. It just did it by itself. I didn't.
Whatever. You know, so you're, so it's like bringing in, creating the ambiance in the space. But I also just love telling stories and fantasy stories. And I have this podcast that I haven't worked on in a while, but it's called Erotically Wasted. Mm. And it's these 10-minute long erotic stories that I started writing for myself. And then I just started sharing them. And I love telling erotic stories to my partners or to my lovers, or, you know, and bringing us all into a juicy fantasy world, you know, that can elicit this activation of the body and to create like a mood and things like that. So it's playing with fantasy there and bringing it into the space. Or I love brainstorming with people about their, you know, what their creations are, what they want to do. I think it's a very entrepreneurial thing to do, but to, you're literally in the space of fantasy, imagining the potential of a person or of a thing or of an event. And that's fantasy, you know, and you're using that in a way to do that.
And you're sharing it.
Yeah. And I think transfiguration, you know, again, the concept of seeing divinity in you know, humanity, is also like seeing the divinity in you and in another person, like the perfectness that we are in this world that we're walking around and having bumps and scratches and, you know? Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And I think, you framed it in a beautifully kind of relational way. When I think about it, I try and apply this perspective and I always lose it and then I reapply it. But it's like, okay, what if all moments were created equal? And what if every single little moment that we have is just as divine as, right? So that the moment when you're giving birth to your child is just as sacred as the moment where you're pouring hot water into your cup, you know? And so it's actually the kitchen tends to be my little temple for practicing this, is little moments of like, you know,
right?
You catch yourself, I don't know if you have a dishwasher, but I catch myself loading the dishwasher in a sort of like slightly angry or martyrish way. And I'm like, put on the song, get into it, you know, relish the fact you have a dishwasher, the freedom.
I make my coffee by hand. So everything there's a whole ritual process of grinding and getting the teapot ready and getting all the pieces ready to pour over. Yum. And I'm breathing it in. And it's so mundane and boring from the outside, but I'm like, la, 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 this is like so beautiful. I get excited. I love doing it. It takes longer, but I like love
it. Yeah, but also look what's at the end of the road. Coffee.
Yes.
Fantasy and reality meet in coffee.
Delicious, delectable coffee. Yes.
Seriously. Okay, so now we're kind of, this is a nice segue into drugs. What's your favorite psychedelic? or drug in general?
Yeah, what is this? God. Oh man, they're so beautiful. Probably I would say either 5-MeO DMT or psilocybin. Yeah, psilocybin for the number of ways that it can change in form and use, and 5-MeO for its power to make you surrender and find a deeper state of surrender, whether it's in the deepest sense of grief that you've been holding on to, or ecstasy, or fear. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very strong medicine, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the most extreme experience I've ever had is with the five.
Probably me too.
Yeah, and the most sort of profoundly, I mean, spiritual is a weird word in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Mine was sexual.
How do we define that? Was it? Oh, yeah, I had a sexual one too. Went into a beautiful, full-blown orgasm.
Oh, yeah.
But the one I'm referring to was a full-blown sort of death process. Like my body kind of like went like a dead rat. I was like, oh, wow. I was like, I literally atrophied and then just blasted out. And to have that simultaneous experience of contraction and unprecedented expansion was just like, oof, what my world. Oh, my God. I feel like I'll be integrating that one till the day I die.
Death tends to do that. Yes.
Requires a lot of integration. Yeah. And I do think that's an important thing to think about in terms of integration is like, how many of these experiences can we tolerate integrating? You know, because they're big.
Mm-hmm.
They're big ones.
I think you said it so pointedly. It is for the rest of our life.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember who said it. If it was Ram Dass or Carl Jung, it was one of them. Who said, you know, that the integration is for death. Like these processes, I think it was Ram Dass, you know, we're all preparing ourselves for death.
Yeah.
And so I think you said it so perfectly. Yeah, it will be lifetime.
It will be lifetime.
Until your death.
Yeah, and you're reminding me, and I haven't ever been able to find who said this, but it used to be sort of circuited around the psychedelic community, which is if you die before you die, you won't have to die when you die. So those little deaths that you get, I guess, also in sex, right? But
That was from the Eleusinian Mysteries.
Oh, well done.
Thank
you.
Brian Marasco, in his book, The Immortality Key. And amazing. The reason why I know that, I know Brian.
Amazing. I'm so happy that that's landed. Okay, good.
Yeah. And now it's, you know, for those who are familiar with the Eleusinian Mysteries and his work in finding the, you know, doing the research on testing the cups, the chalices that had ergot, elements of ergot in it, which is an element of LSD in the cup that they used. Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Got it.
Little deaths.
Little deaths. Yeah. Yeah. The value of death. I love that. I noticed sort of researching you before this conversation that you've been working with ketamine and sex or sexual trauma and ketamine.
So I work with ketamine in my clinical office for trauma and sexual dysfunctions and for sexual trauma. But then I also set up protocols for people who are exploring sex and psychedelics. So psychedelics to help us to expand on our sexual potential.
That's awesome. Yeah. I want to talk about this. I've got a personal interest in this because when I had sex on ketamine recently, it was very like, it makes me think of the British high five I do where it never quite like connects. I was super enthusiastic about the sex, but I couldn't quite it was like wasn't quite working. I think maybe I took too much ketamine. Would that have been the case?
That could have been the case.
It could have been the case because I think I was like, it was a little bit of maybe a little numbing or something.
Yeah, so it's classified as a dissociator. Yeah. And at high doses, you can have a psychedelic experience, an out-of-body experience. Mm. And what I do clinically is I do lower doses so people can stay connected to their body. So like moderate to low doses. Mm.
What is a moderate to low? We're talking about the lozenges?
So if we're doing lozenges, it would be between 50 and 150.
Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
150 would be like the highest of that realm. And then IM would be about 15 to 50. Mm. So in that range. As that looks in the work that I do at lower doses, it acts as it lifts you out of the dissociation. So dissociation is the process in which our attention goes outside of us, right? And that's a protector part inside of us that doesn't want to feel the pain in the body or whatever we're storing in here. But with ketamine, it almost like creates this bubble where it lifts the heaviness of anxiety or depression or chronic pain so that we can be with the body in a better, more easeful way. So we can be with the emotions. We can see anxiety. We can see fear. We can see, you know, sadness and have dialogue with it. I've had so many clients in my sessions be able to access pleasure in their body after having sexual trauma because they have not been able to be in the body. It was too scary.
So the ketamine helps you disassociate from the disassociation. Exactly. It helps you separate from the disassociation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting. It's kind of paradoxical.
It is paradoxical. Yeah. And in my ketamine-assisted therapy training, I had this intention. We were doing a... we were working with ketamine on each other. And I was like, I'm going to have the intention to see how I can use this for sex therapy. And so I took it and I'm lying back there and I'm like, okay, can I connect with my body? Okay, yes, I can still connect with my body. I think I had 150 milligrams at the time. And I was like, okay, I can feel my body. Okay, can I feel my pussy? Okay, I can feel my hips. I can, okay, what happens if I start moving a little bit, if I start breathing? And I just started using my practices from Tantra. And then next thing I knew, I had a full-blown energetic orgasm.
Wow.
And I sat up afterward, and we're in the integration circle, and this is a room of doctors and therapists, and everybody looks at me like, okay, what did you have?
How much did she have?
I know, But it helped me to realize, you know, like our bodies can tense, our bodies can be filled with heaviness and sadness, and then this lifts and it lightens and it makes everything feel okay, like I'm going to be okay in the world. And even just that opening of the body, it may not be the type of sex that we're conditioned to think of, which is like penetration or, you know, the bodies, but it can be energetic. Whether with our own selves or with another person, you know, the narrow definition prevents us from actually accessing how sex could be.
I love the sound of the work that you're doing. And I feel like there's so many different conversations you and I could have given our intersection of sex and psychedelics. Yeah. While I have your expertise at hand, for somebody listening to this who may not have access to ketamine or may not want to do ketamine, but is feeling like they kind of want to explore their own sexuality in a way that's maybe more energetic. Is there something you would suggest, a tool perhaps?
Yes, yes. Yeah. So I trademarked this model called aerosynthesis, and it's on my website. I also did a talk on this with the Psychedelic Association in Canada, and it's on YouTube. And so it goes through these different practices of breath and sound and movement and visualization and touch as tools to be able to make our psychedelic experience erotic and then to be able to integrate. So these are all tools that we can use to integrate whatever we experience in the psychedelic realm. I hear from people that they have sexual experiences in psychedelics, but then they don't know how to get back to it, you know?
Yeah.
And so this can help us to be able to access those things.
It sounds amazing. So we find this where?
You can find it on my website at sexloveyoga.com.
Sexloveyoga.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, or also sexlovepsychedelics.co. And then also on YouTube, I introduced it to the Canadian Association for Psychedelics.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Thank you so much. Before we wrap up, because I know I have to let you go at some point, tell me about where you see your work going and your hope for the future of sex, love, yoga, sex, love, and psychedelics.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a really strong passion for, I mean, obviously the sex and the trauma and just helping people to come back into right relationship with it. And so I'm providing integration practices online. I think that's where we're missing. We don't have enough of integration. And so I have these classes called Undone Yoga, and they're for women to come into their sensuality doing yoga and breath work and dance in their underwear. I've done this since 2018, and it's been really powerful for women to...
It's online?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. We're coming back to online. It's been a while since I've done the online ones. And then the in-person I did monthly until the pandemic. And then now we're bringing those back online. So I think a big part for me is to create spaces for people to integrate and to keep the practices going where like there's a lot of facilitators, you know, or things that are popping up, but then people don't know what to do afterward, you know, and that's,
yes.
you know, we got to provide these places. So integration circles and those actions and everything, creating a safe space for sex positivity, you know, because there's even a lack of that in even some of these integration circles, like it's, or in on stages at conferences about psychedelics, you know, over the last year, I've been seeing more colleagues speaking on that too, and it's awesome. And so we just need to remind the academic world, we need to remind the spiritual world, you know, that eroticism, that sex positivity and all its facets is also welcome. I think there's just a lot of fear, or people just don't know how to hold the space for it. And so I want to create that.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm so delighted you're doing this work. And it also pulls focus for me on the idea that homecoming is not a one and done thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, I did my ayahuasca and I found myself, or this happened. And it's like it's an ongoing thing to come back to our bodies, out of the noise, out of the chaos, out of the disassociation, and back into meeting ourselves wherever we actually are is an ongoing thing. And I love that you're making space for that. So thank you. And thank you for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, darling.